Welcome to Season 9, Episode 29 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Tuesday the 13th of September, and we're going to discuss what's been happening in the news and in the community. I'm Mark, and joining me this week are Alan.
Hello, hello.
And Martin.
Hello.
And no Laura this week, unfortunately.
Oh,
that's a shame. Laura's very busy, apparently.
Hiya!
No, don't do that.
Oh. Anyway, how have you two been? Alan, what have you been doing?
I've been running GNOME Shell instead of Unity on my laptop.
Good Lord.
Yes, I know. There's two reasons for this, right? One is, I went on this Brian Lundug thing where we were all talking about different desktops, and someone asked me a question about, you know, running other desktops. And I sat and thought, well, I've run Unity for years and years and years. Maybe I should have a look at one of these others and see what's different and see, you know, if they do things differently, which obviously they do. But also, last week I had a kind of glitch on my laptop where the mouse kept getting stuck on the screen. It would stick like the mouse had gone over like a dent in the desk or something.
I know the thing you mean. I've seen that.
Right. And I couldn't for the life of me figure out what it was. I started uninstalling stuff, killing things, like stopping stuff, rebooting everything. And it didn't do it. And I thought, well, maybe it's something in my desktop. So, you know, it could be Compiz or Unity or something like that. So I've shifted to GNOME Shell just to eliminate that from my inquiries. And it still happens once in a while when I'm on GNOME Shell. So it's not that, but I've stayed on GNOME Shell for a bit anyway, just to.
And how are you finding it?
It's frustrating. One interesting.
Ringing endorsement there from Alan Pope.
Sorry. When you're used to, I've been using Unity for 6 years or something, you know, using something different is frustrating because, you know, someone moved my cheese. But interestingly, Audio Recorder, you know, the little Audio Recorder app that we use, it has a little thing that bounces up and down.
Yeah.
It looks wrong in Unity. It looks right in GNOME Shell. So it's a GTK thing.
It looks right in that other distribution as well, by the way.
Interesting.
I'm not sure what you mean by wrong or right. Every time I use it, it seems to look different.
Actually, it's wrong on Ubuntu Mate on Samantha's computer, actually.
Have you installed the right version?
Yeah. Anyway, that's what I've been up to.
Martin, how about you?
I've been migrating the servers for the distribution that we won't name to Bytemark.
We've already named it.
I thought we'd managed to avoid.
No, I think Alan dropped the UM bomb.
Okay. So, Bytemark are very kindly sponsoring Ubuntu Mate, and they've picked up all of our hosting costs and bandwidth costs and have given us free reign over their big V platform. So,
Good Lord.
Yeah, so, and that's quite a big deal because it's really those Raspberry Pi images that we make, which are a community effort. We've been hosting those ourselves, and they generate a staggering amount of bandwidth, and they're covering that. So Matthew Block, their CEO, is an Ubuntu Mate user, and he reached out a few weeks ago. And so that's one less cost for the project, and some more of the crowdfunding money can now go towards developers working on projects for Mate Desktop and Ubuntu Mate.
That's
and
really
in the interest of
nice
balance, we should probably also mention that Bitfolk cover the hosting for the Ubuntu podcast.
Yes, that's Bitfolk.
Other VPSs are available.
Yes. Right, I think enough of this madness. Let's get on with the show.
And now it's time for the news. And first up in the news this week is a practical joke. Adobe has announced a new beta version of the Flash Player for Linux.
What?
And everybody said, what?
Just like that.
What's going on here? So this new release
is
going to bring it up to date with the Windows and Mac versions. So really, all the way up from 11 to whatever Windows and Mac
15 or something, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, Chrome is on 20 something or other. I don't know what the official Adobe version is. So they're going to drag it all the way up to date.
Yeah, that's what they said.
Right. But they're not going to implement all the features. It's just going to be.
They're not going to implement any of the useful features for. I shouldn't be so flippant.
You see, Flash is one of those things I stopped caring about. Partly because, you know, it's Flash and, you know, yada, 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 I don't care, non-free, et cetera. But partly because there's so little I use that is Flash. I mean, I know there are people out there who use it a lot for, you know, stuff like playing Flash games. And I'm sure my kids would be annoyed with me if I gave them a computer that didn't have Flash. So part of the reason I've stopped caring is because I use a browser that has it built in because I have Chrome. Mm-hmm. So this whole auto updating, you know, it all magically works thing is great because I don't have to worry about this kind of stuff. And so this kind of news is a kind of interesting.
What's interesting about this is why have they done this? What would have motivated Adobe to suddenly completely backtrack on this and start supporting it again indefinitely?
Money.
Given, yeah.
From a partner, probably. I would imagine this is a partner that they have who have some kind of system. I would, you know, let's speculate, in-flight entertainment systems, car systems, anything which has got Linux underneath, which might have, you know, Flash games on it or any kind of application that's written in Flash. And now that those things are becoming more connected, maybe they're making demand, their partners who make these hardware devices or software devices are making demands that actually you need to update this thing because it's a security hole in our, you know, infotainment system, perhaps.
That's interesting.
The reason I used to care about Flash about this time last year was because there are a number of premium streaming video services in the UK that you couldn't access without Adobe Flash on Firefox with the DRM module. And Chrome doesn't do that. Its sandboxing prevents that DRM piece from functioning. So the DRM piece is missing again from this, but I don't care anymore because all of the premium streaming services I care about now work with HTML5 implementations. But the reason I do care about Flash now is because of my daughter, and a lot of her learning content is delivered through the learning portals Flash-based content. So it does mean that as Chrome talk about, you know, phasing out Flash, then it looks like Firefox and Flash on Linux now have some longevity to give kids access to educational material. So I'm pleased in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, I always thought it was ludicrous that MIT, when they switched from Scratch 1 to Scratch 2, decided to use Flash as the platform of choice for their latest version of Scratch. And, you know, that was years ago. And I guess now, you know, now that there's going to be updates, that's going to mean people who run, you know, Linux systems can carry on using that. So, yeah, that's good news, I guess. And there is a good side to this.
Mixed messages.
Dennis Hamilton, the Vice President of Apache OpenOffice, has begun a discussion about the project's retirement.
Mm. When you say retirement, you know, we're talking about putting it in a box and moving it to, you know, to a filing cabinet with, you know.
Oh, I thought you were going to say and moving it into a hole that's 6 feet deep.
Interestingly enough, they've got this project called the Apache Attic, which is the retirement home of Apache projects. So that just sort of archives all of their assets and stuff.
Hmm. Okay.
And does anyone care?
Good question. I mean, obviously not enough developers care to make it viable, which is the reason for this discussion. It's basically, it's not kind of discussing why it's happened, but essentially the point is that, you know, they're in a situation where there's, you know, there's security releases, security issues which are being disclosed because they're live issues and no one is around to fix them because no one really cares. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's been a long time coming, really.
Does this? Yeah. So the only drawback I can see here is the concern of monoculture that, you know, all we have now is LibreOffice, or is there another open source office suite that can compete?
KOffice?
Caligra?
I've never tried it. Caligra, yeah.
We have it. What else? Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, before we only had OpenOffice and it wasn't a particularly big problem, was it? Or was it? Show it at UbuntuPodcast.org.
Well, it was better than not having an office suite at all, that was for sure.
Yes.
Yeah, but not having an office suite at all is a very long time ago in the grand scheme of things. You know, we had Star Office, then Open Office, mm-hmm. and that was a long, 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 long time ago. Mm-hmm. That it was, you know, we now have one very, very good. If everyone who, you know, bemoans the fact that everything's moving to the web and, you know, they don't have an office suite. If they just throw some money at the Document Foundation and make LibreOffice better. We interviewed them, a couple of people from the Document Foundation, a couple of seasons ago. And, you know, they could do with the help. So it would be lovely if this whole brouhaha between LibreOffice and OpenOffice was put to bed and those developers just moved over and helped make LibreOffice better.
It would be good for people outside the open source community to have some clarity as to which open source office suite they should be downloading as well.
Mm.
Yeah, unfortunately, LibreOffice never quite became the household name, which is kind of embarrassing. Now, if you go to openoffice.org, compared to what it used to be like, that it now looks like the website for a software project, not the website for a product.
Mm. Right. Okay, moving on. The American Civil Liberties Union and Amnesty International have called upon President Obama to pardon Edward Snowden. Snowden, who, you know, released loads of documents revealing the kind of activities that three-letter acronym organizations and governments were doing in order to spy on their users and their citizens, rather. he's now living in exile. It's 3 years now he's been living in Russia. God, that time
crazy.
Flies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you think of all the freedom we have to, you know, do whatever it is we do, and that guy's what he's done and now lives in exile in Russia. I'm sure it's not, you know, living in a hole in the ground, but I feel bad for the guy. Yes, so they've described Snowden as a great American who deserves clemency for his patriotic acts. And maybe, you know, when I'm sitting in my rocking chair in 5 years' time, in 20 years' time, and, you know, my grandchildren, you know, are watching the hologram news where they talk about Edward Snowden is now flying back to the US and he's a free man. Maybe, you know, I'll look back on today and think, you know, I can remember when all that kicked off. I can't see it happening. Given the state of American politics, I just can't see this happening.
Is it my imagination, or is as presidents get to the end of their, you know, term, you often see stories about them being approached to issue pardons. Is the timing coincidental, or is that what's going on here? You know,
I'd imagine there's a part of that.
Yeah. Part of that. And also partly it's the same week that the biopic about Edward Snowden comes out.
There we go.
So he's in the consciousness, and, you know, people are going to see the movie and it's got a famous actor in it who plays Ed Snowden. So, you know, that might help. People contacting their, you know, represented officials in government, but I just can't see it happening at all. Not in the next 10 years. That's my prediction. Moving on.
Well, tune into Ubuntu podcast season 19 and see if Alan was right.
Yes, on your holographic podcast downloading tool.
Oh, they're going to be like little, like Princess Leia, little versions of us standing on the desk.
Really hope
no.
Help me, Edward Snowden. You're my only hope.
Oh dear.
In happier news, the Raspberry Pi Foundation has sold its 10 millionth computer, and I did do the thing with my pinky as I said that. To celebrate this milestone, the foundation has released an official Raspberry Pi starter kit.
What's in this official starter kit that's not in every other starter kit that's available
everywhere
else?
It's what's in every other starter kit, but it's an official one.
One now, yeah.
It's funny, I was looking at their store, and I didn't even know there was a Raspberry Pi store. I somehow stumbled across it when Les Pounder posted a picture of a Raspberry Pi sticker or something, and he posted a link to the store. And I saw that there's a little bear you can get, the Raspberry Pi bear. I can't remember what his name is.
But yes,
Babbage. That's it.
Yeah, Babbage. We gave some away at Odd Camp.
Oh, right. 1 year. And he has a little rucksack, and in the rucksack you can get a little kit, which is a breadboard, some LEDs, some wires. So he's got a little kit that he can carry around. It's rather cute.
Excellent.
Yes. So so that's good news that the Raspberry Pi Foundation have hit 10 million. That's lots.
And I think the original objective was to sell 10,000.
And how many are in cupboards and drawers boxes and stuff, I wonder?
Well, I mean, I've got lots of them now. I mean, I probably have one or two that are in use, as in, you know, projects developing at any one time, but I think I've got about 6 or 7, like you say, yeah, in states of deconstruction and what have you, yeah, in various drawers and what have you.
We should talk about this at more length in a later episode. Perhaps next week, I think, would be a good
perhaps
idea.
Next week.
Yes. Moving on.
Next up, Pixar has released Universal Scene Description, a system for encoding 3D scene data for exchange between animation software under an open source license.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's all on GitHub, and you can grab the source and attempt to build it yourself. It's a bit specific on what it builds. Pixar are internally a Red Hat and CentOS kind of shop, so all the stuff builds fine on Red Hat and CentOS machines. It would be tricky building it on anything else, but some people have reported issues of you know, it not building here or not building there, and the developers have, you know, pointed out how to fix stuff, and frustratingly, a lot of the issues that get reported on GitHub for this software, you get a one-line response, which is, we've copied this to our internal bug tracker. Oh. It's like, well, yeah, that's disappeared then.
Yeah. I thought that for building this, snaps might be a good place to start. I thought a multi-part source snap could well be suited to building this.
So have a look at the issue that I reported about me trying to make this thing into a multi-part snap.
Almost like I've seen it.
Yeah, it's but I mean, watching the video of them, yeah, doing their demo on stage with a System 76 laptop, mm-hmm, admittedly running some Red Hat based thing, and loading up their software and in making real-time changes to the 3D scene. I mean, it's a very niche, very specific product, but it was very cool to see that he was doing it all on Linux.
Yeah.
It was very, very, very cool.
Yeah, I remember seeing a documentary, I think it was about The Incredibles or something, a few years ago, and like it just sort of showed them doing something with like a 3D model of one of the characters, and it was clearly a Linux desktop, and I was just like, yes.
I always thought that we were still stuck in the days of, you know, they would plot everything and then send it off to batch overnight, and then the next morning they get a frame or something. But, you know,
well,
things have moved on a lot
in terms
since
of
then.
The final render, that's still the case. But the speed at which they can actually work on this stuff in real time now is just astonishing.
Yeah. On commodity desktops and laptops that you can just like buy in a shop.
And in fact, that System 76 laptop is almost identical to the Entroware Athena that I have. So there you go for a reference on the hardware. And these tech demos that are using high-end graphics and real-time processing now, you say, you know, isn't it nice to see Linux? But it's becoming sort of almost commonplace to see Linux operating systems used for these high-end demonstrations now. A lot of the stuff that Nvidia do now is demonstrated with Ubuntu, for example. Yeah. So yeah, maybe
Tesla's, and all the in-car, you know, stuff. Yeah.
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 And finally, in gaming news, the Dolphin emulator for Nintendo Wii and GameCube games has announced that it can now boot all officially released GameCube titles. The final one, which was Star Wars Clone Wars, it has now been booted. It doesn't work perfectly within the emulator, and you obviously have to get hold of a copy of the game, which might be dodgy. But they provided a detailed blog post, which we'll link to, about some of the memory management tricks involved in getting some of these games to run inside an emulator. And I always find these kind of articles super fascinating about how they reverse engineer, you know, a box that you would normally buy and put under the TV, how they figure out all the internals and, you know, and work out a software solution to emulate what that thing is doing. It's super fascinating.
And there's some really bizarre stuff going on. Like the GameCube only actually has something like 24 meg of RAM, but it pretends to have 4 gig, and there has to be, like, there's really some hardware memory management going on when they're trying to emulate as little of it as possible, but still make the game work.
Wow.
It's really crazy.
Yeah, it's worth a read. Super. I think that's the end of the news, isn't it?
Yes.
And And now it's time for community news and events. And first up, we have a blog post from a game developer, Max Ed, who blogged about his experience with Ubuntu Touch development. And I put this in here because it's nice to see people who aren't within the Ubuntu bubble or within the, you know, the SDK team or, you know, our friends, having a go at using some of the tools we've created and providing feedback on, you know, how it went, the good things, the gnarly bits and all that kind of stuff. And it was a nice detailed post.
It really was.
Yeah.
I read really this some weeks ago when he first published it, and yeah, it did the rounds just again recently. It is a good read.
And he develops for iOS and Android as well, so it's good to have someone who's got like experience of developing for mobile platforms in general to give their opinion.
Mm.
And in related Ubuntu phone development news, the Ubuntu SDK IDE 4.1.0 has been released. With shiny new stuff.
So one of the things that's changed in this release is something they've been talking about for a while. It's based on a newer version of Qt Creator, but one of the things that's fundamentally changed is rather than building application, let's say your application is a C++ Qt application, rather than it building inside a Chroot environment in order to build like an ARM binary for a phone, it uses LXC and LXD to build inside a container, which is faster, more robust, and a little less shonky than doing it in a Chroot, which is really good to see. And it's been exercised quite a lot. There's a Telegram group where the guys who maintain the Ubuntu SDK IDE hang out, and they've been getting a lot of feedback from people, you know, all hours of the day and night, from people who have been testing this stuff out once this blog post went live, and, you know, reporting issues and getting their stuff fixed. So it's really nice to see, you know, two-way communication between the people who are working on this stuff and people who are consuming it as well. It's really good.
Cool. Next up, Canonical's Will Cook has announced improvements to Unity 7's low graphics mode.
Yeah. This is interesting because, you know, the whole Unity 7 is dead, you know, nobody's maintaining it anymore, yet, you know, these little drive-by updates to Unity 7 come along, which are actually quite useful. And this one's quite neat because it allows you to run Unity 7 on lower spec hardware, but it's probably more useful in a virtualized environment.
Ah, right. Okay.
So,
yes.
Like, typically, like, desktop environments which have a heavyweight, like, 3D component are not best suited for running in a VM.
And you could perhaps use this if you're one of these crazy people who's getting Unity running on Ubuntu for Windows.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This might be a better choice for your weird Windows-based X server than full-blown Unity.
I hadn't thought of that. I was also thinking about, you know, if you wanted to have Martin's often talked about this, how he sometimes has a remote machine that he will connect into and and run a GUI on that remote machine. Might be useful in those environments so that you're not placing a heavy workload on the remote machine where you're running the graphical interface, but also you're not sending over the wire lots of, you know, unnecessary shader effects and all that kind of stuff. You know, you just show me the window, don't do with all the effects, which is basically what this does. It like dials down the visual effects on
excellent.
Next up, you can now register for the first European Ubuntu conference, the UbuCon Europe. We mentioned this a few times in our upcoming events section, and now they've published a page where you can actually register to go to the event.
Excellent. Is it free or is there a registration fee?
I haven't read it. I think there's a small you're free to register, but I think they're trying to make it a super small fee when you get there.
Okay. I see. Right.
So
yes,
you know, to help pay for the coffee.
Yeah, pay for this. Yes, these things like are quite expensive to put on.
Yes.
Next up, Elementary OS 0.4 Loki has been released. I think we spoke about the beta release a month or so ago now.
Yep. And this one was interesting. They did a lot of marketing PR blitz with countdowns and build up to the event and all that kind of stuff. And they did a live video stream with Chris Fisher from Jupiter Broadcasting going through some of the new features and some of the stuff. It was quite good to watch. Yeah, it was a nice way to do it because Chris actually had a desktop there running Loki, so he could, while the developers Cassidy and Daniel were on the line, they could talk through the interesting stuff and he could demo it in real time. Yeah. So you could see what you're going to get before you actually, download the ISO. It's pretty good.
Yes, we've often lamented lack of marketing in open source, and that's actually quite a clever way of doing it, I think.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. And I haven't tried it yet. I might give it a go, probably in a VM. But the thing that stops me using, like I mentioned earlier, how I've switched to using GNOME Shell for a bit, the thing that blocks me doing that and switching to, elementary is it's a whole reinstall. It's a completely switch of operating system. It's not just a, add a PPA and chuck a couple of packages on, which I would be okay with on my main machine. I just can't reinstall I'm not a distro hopper.
And finally, the Linux AIO project has published a single ISO image with all of the Ubuntu 16.04.1 LTS flavors.
Yeah, they've been doing this for a while. They've done it over a few years. They create these gigantic images, and they are pretty gigantic because it's got loads of ISOs actually on one ISO.
So it's not an ISO where you can boot into all the desktops. It's all of the ISOs multi-boot.
Yeah, effectively, So you pick and choose which one you want, and they've been modified slightly so they fit and to put their menu on and all that kind of stuff. But it basically is just a menu front end to a bunch of ISOs so that if you were doing like a demo or something, or you wanted to, someone said, which one should I try? You could say, well, try them all, and here's a disk that's got them all on, so you can try one, and if you don't like it, try a different one. And
I guess it's aimed at USBs rather than actual optical media, unless you're doing it on a Blu-ray.
Yeah, I think they did do it on a DVD at one point. It's a dual, a dual layer DVD would be, 9 gig, something like that?
Right. So that could do it.
You could probably get it on a DVD, but then it gets a bit expensive, and USB sticks are super cheap these days.
And no one has optical drives anymore.
Well, there is that. I'm just looking around, and I don't have any machines with optical drives, so yes, that's true. Okay, I think that's all the community news. Should we have a look at the events?
Let's have a look at the events.
So coming up very soon now, so you need to be pretty quick. In Berlin is the Next Cloud conference. It's on September 16th to the 22nd.
Right. So if you're listening to this on the day it goes out, it's tomorrow.
Yes. If you go to, if you're in Berlin and you're not doing anything and you're interested in Next Cloud, then go to conf.nextcloud.com. And they've got some interesting speakers and discussion topics about Next Cloud.
Cool. And there's the Retro Gaming and Vintage Computer Day, a day where people can drop in and out and see and play a range of retro consoles and vintage computers. The range varieties from the Atari 2600 to the Commodore 64 and Amiga to as recent as the Microsoft Xbox and Sony PS2. Worth going just for the Amiga.
Yes, actually, totally true. When's that?
That's at the Flutterby's Tea Room and Coffee Shop in Great Yarmouth, Norfolk. So that also sounds worth going just for the venue.
Yes. I like the sound of a Flutterby's Tea Room. It's on the 24th of October. Next up is Egham Raspberry Jam. Yum, yum. The theme is winter fun, Halloween, bonfire nights, cold weather, that kind of stuff. So bring along your Raspberry Pis that are overclocked and make them...
keeping you warm.
Pocket warmer. That's a great idea for a Raspberry Pi project. Come and see and learn about robotics, programming, electronics, development, creativity. Sunday, 16th of October, 2 till 5 p.m. And it's at the Gartner UK office in Staines-on-Thames.
Oh, it's called Staines-upon-Thames now, is it?
Apparently so, yes.
Lovely. Next up, there's Mini DebConf Cambridge. So there's 2 days of Mini Deb Camp, which is on the Thursday and Friday, which is a space for development, sprints and meetings. And the rest of the weekend is 2 days Mini Deb Conf on the Saturday and Sunday, which is more general talks. That's in Cambridge in the UK, 10th to 13th of November.
Awesome. And finally, we mentioned it earlier, UbuCon Europe, very first European Ubuntu conference, 2 days of talks, workshops, demos, exhibitions, and hopefully great food, social events in evenings, and the opportunity to meet fellow community members at Unperfect House Essen in Germany, 18th to the 20th of November. And I think that's all of the events.
We love getting your feedback, so please send it to us. Even the pointlessly mean stuff makes us laugh. If it's short, tweet us on @UbuntuPodcast. If it's less short, but please no essays, email us on show@UbuntuPodcast.org. If you'd like to discuss some of the things we talk about with other listeners, post on our shiny new subreddit at reddit.com/r/UbuntuPodcast. Or you can just leave a comment on the relevant show notes on our website, UbuntuPodcast.org.
Ah, oh, Laura made it on after all.
Oh, yeah. Well done.
So that's all for episode 29. We'll be back next week where we'll be discussing the 10 millionth Raspberry Pi, and we will bring you some command line love, and we'll go over your feedback.
And hopefully better internet connections.
Yes. Those would be good.
Yes. Awesome. Okay. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye. Stop!